Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMS says their multi-million dollar crisis alert system doesn't work and they want their money back. The company that installed it says they fixed it, so who's right? The town of Matthews and CMS reconcile as Matthews promises not to pursue municipal charter schools. CMPD Chief Kerputney says he's got everything he needs to keep the peace and keep Charlotte safe during the Republican National Convention. And hot off his win in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders heads to the Belk Theater here in Charlotte this afternoon. For supporters, it will be a love fest for Valentine's Day. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and seated around this table are David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner is chief investigative reporter for WBTV News. Hello there.
I tried to think of a witty thing to say for Valentine's Day. I have not. Nothing.
Okay. And that's probably
good
a
night.
Good thing. Good night, Gracie. And Eric Spanberg is a managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome back. Welcome back.
You're all heart, Mike.
I know I am. We're all on Facebook Live this morning, too. So there you go. In response to school shootings around the country, CMS announced the installation of a state-of-the-art security system a few months ago. They invested over $1 million. But a month ago, Superintendent Ernest Winston announced that it didn't work, and he gave the company that installed it 30 days to make it work. That deadline arrived on Monday. And the verdict?
We still do not have a system that is reliable and delivers what was promised.
That's School Board Superintendent Ernest Winston. The school system wants their money back, but the company that developed it and installed it, Syntegix, out of Atlanta, disagrees with Mr. Winston's assessment. What are they saying?
Well, it's really been a beautiful game of dueling press releases this week.
Yeah.
Because
long press releases.
And you remember on Tuesday afternoon, the Atlanta company puts out the release that says everything's good, all systems go, we have fixed everything. And then, of course, the clip you just played was delivered by Ernest Winston just a couple of hours later. And then Wednesday, the firm followed up again and said that this was a politically motivated decision, that there is no problem here, and that the CMS system has gotten exactly what they asked for.
So let's talk about all this. The company says all 26 of the contracted high schools completed quality assurance testing, met all of the agreed upon success criteria, and are ready for teacher training and deployment.
You know, if this wasn't a million-dollar dispute, I think we might be tempted to laugh at it. You know, you didn't do it. Yes, I did. No, you didn't.
Well, how can there be disagreement? It either works or it doesn't.
Well, it's interesting. And as Eric mentioned, this has played out in public with the dueling press releases. We might suspect that there's something going on behind the scenes, but we also learned this week that Ernest Winston did not contact the company before he made his public statement about it. And that, I guess, has forced the company to come back with its press release about it.
Which they put out on Twitter, by the way.
Well, they did it moments before or a couple hours before he made his statement, so they must have known something was coming.
Yeah.
My colleague Ann Helms, who's been covering this for WFAE, says this is going to go to court because the issues here are all wrapped up. Now, one other thing we need to remember is there's not actually a contract here. This was done with purchase orders. And
who
so,
made that decision, David?
Well, maybe it was our previous superintendent. Right. It was under his watch. I'm not sure who exactly made that decision. But when they get to court, what they'll be disputing is whether the company has met the requirements of this and whether there was ever any firm agreement on exactly what they were delivering.
Glenn?
It also appears, based on the press release, that CMS is still using the system.
Syntegix.
Syntegix, yes, thank you. Syntegix listed several recent instances.
Including last week.
Yeah, where the school system was apparently using the system. So if it's not working, they apparently haven't abandoned it altogether.
Well, here's what they said. They said that their system works and was used the morning of the press release to trigger a modified campus lockdown for an unspecified event at Garinger High School, and it worked. And they went on to say, "We are disappointed. CMS leadership chose not to work with us and to ignore the successful completion of testing. Our many requests for contact with leadership received no response. The lack of transparency and collaboration is unfair to vendors and does not advance the goal of enhancing student safety." How reputable is this firm? Anybody know anything about them?
I can't say how reputable they are. I went to their website and I saw that they do work with other school systems.
So this is not the first system that they've installed. Is this the first system of this size?
Yeah, no, they work with a number. I saw the same thing. They work with a number of school systems. Now, how effective, I have no idea.
And here's where we got to jump in, Mike, and parse the statements. So Ernest Winston and the school system isn't saying it doesn't work at all. It says it doesn't work reliably and consistently, and specifically it doesn't do some key things that they thought it was going to do. Syntegix says, "We met all of our benchmarks and the success metrics," or it was some corporate word that like that.
And you notice, Nick, they said something like there were aspects that they were not asked
to do. That's right, like tracking teachers, which is a thing that Winston specifically said they couldn't do. Now, here's why all of this is a problem, because there's no contract. So where are the success metrics? Where are they written down? Where do we know? How did we know?
All we have is the original RFP, the request for proposals, mm-hmm. which presumably the CMS staff is holding the company to. You mentioned about tracking teachers. That apparently was not in the RFP, according to Syntegix. So that's one of those things that'll get haggled in court.
Let's not forget that when Ernest Winston was appointed as the superintendent, he did go out to the public and tout this system. Remember, CMS has touted this system again and again while they know it is not working, or while they say it is not working.
And so, again, the company, in its second statement in response to the contract being canceled, has said, look, all of the team at CMS that we're working with on a daily basis agrees that we have met our benchmarks here, and almost says that the people they talk to that are employed by CMS on a daily basis disagrees with what the superintendent is saying.
In a statement, I think they sent it to us here at WFAE, the company detailed they detailed the terms of their claiming to work with CMS and the project team on testing, saying that the testing team at CMS repeatedly received feedback from CMS personnel, and that the solution was consistently performing as promised.
And that CMS leadership agrees that the core function is, quote, flawless. this is something that I guess a judge does have to settle.
And this is the problem with fake transparency. There's no transparency about any of this, because if we had actual transparency, we'd see documents and testing results.
There would be a contract.
How does that happen?
The company's making a lot of claims in a statement, but not releasing anything. Of course, they're not obligated to do anything because they're a private company. CMS is making claims. They are subject to the Public Records Act, and yet we've seen no public records. And the school board, we all know, has a history of saying one thing and doing another, or saying one thing and another thing being actually the truth. And so who's the most reputable person here? I think the award goes to no one.
We'll talk about the allegation on the part of the company that this is all politically motivated. What could that mean?
Well, I assume, and this is just a hunch because we don't know, I assume that it's some of what Nick is saying, which is that there is this idea that the leadership is against them, but the people that are in the trenches dealing with them day to day like what they're seeing. I think that is what the company is getting at.
I don't think that's politics to me. I think that line is a little baffling.
Yeah. That's the best I can come up with.
So we spent $1.1 million on this. So they're due to pay the company an additional $600,000 upon satisfaction of that it works. Clearly, we're not going to pay that $600,000, and they want to get the $1.1 million back. Do we know how they intend to do that, Glenn?
Ernest Winston has not said how they will do that. So, and I can tell you, it's probably going to involve a court of law.
I don't think he knows how he's going to get it back. Again, I think his case might be a little stronger, as I said earlier, if they weren't actually still using the system.
Well, and if there were a contract, right? A contract would have a clawback mechanism.
So, while this goes on in court, and it will go on in court, and it will go on in court for a long time.
By the way, will they spend more or less than $1.1 million to resolve this?
The other question is, if it doesn't work, Are they going to put another system in the interim while we wait for the court case to be decided?
That's a very good question.
We don't know about the interim. The superintendent, Ernest Winston, did say that they would continue to look at technology as it is developed, but he didn't put a time frame on it.
You know what's going on there is like it's the disaster du jour over at CMS. The ongoing saga of troubles, it continues with this. Last week we find out that CMS has decided to scale back the size of new high schools that it promised to build in the 2017 $1 billion bond campaign. No one seemed to be aware that those decisions had been made. Half of the money had been earmarked for new high schools with 125 classrooms each. Someone at CMS decided we don't need those. We only need 100 classrooms each because there are new growth patterns. Okay. So this week, CMS formally asked Mecklenburg County commissioners for more money to complete these scaled back school construction projects. Why do you need more for less?
I don't think we've gotten a good answer on that, right?
Yeah, first of all, we don't know exactly how much more they need. They haven't said that yet.
Why not?
They're still.
I think what they said was, "We need more money. We'll be back. We'll be back with you with the numbers."
But is it the abacus they use to count that up? I'm not sure, but
they're still using new math.
The new math. I mean, one thing that's been mentioned already is land costs for a couple of the new schools. I guess being higher than anticipated. I assume the other thing that's going to creep into this, which is obvious anywhere around town, construction costs have obviously gone up because the economy is so good. But the real mess here is what you alluded to at the beginning, which is that as this became apparent, it was never disclosed publicly, or it was disclosed too late publicly.
Which is, again, goes back to the no one trusts CMS because they do things like this. It's perfectly reasonable, and it happens all the time. It happens like once a week at the city, it feels like, that, this project that was slated to be done is going to be way over budget because of construction and land costs. It's Charlotte.
Right. And we do need to note that it's not illegal for CMS to not know exactly what these projects are going to be. When you do a bond in North Carolina, you say what the general topic is going to be for, but you're not held to any specific projects.
So, right.
But still, transparency in the whole process here is something that people are looking for among all the other things that CMS does.
So
this is going to come up at a public hearing on the 2017 bond projects on February 25th.
So County Commission Chairman George Dunlop says that he is receptive to hearing the request, but he needs more information. And he noted that CMS Board Chair Elise Dashew admitted the system hadn't communicated well on the issue and plans to revamp the system for better transparency. There's that word again. When it comes to schools, demographics, geography all play a role. Construction costs, real estate prices play a role. Is that what this is basically all about, or is there more to this?
I don't think we know. I mean, I don't think we have a good answer on that. And I think another question that's already popped up and you'll hear again is, how much culpability does the new superintendent have? Because obviously he was part of CMS while this was going on all along, even when he wasn't superintendent. So this is going to be another messy conversation for the school board.
And I think part of what's happening here, at least for the moment, they're able to blame it on this transition of superintendents. You know, what is it, the seventh in the last 10 years or something?
So Phil Malik, another county commissioner, gave the school board a scolding on Tuesday night over the changes. She said, quote, "You're saying now that you're going to renege on the plans that you gave to the public. You don't need to lose that public trust." And she added, "We want to trust you." But she said, "Here we go again with a board we thought that cared about the community and could keep their word and be honest and fair with the people." And she noted a decades-long problem with a history of the school system breaking promises to the African-American community. Glenn, I have 20 seconds. Is that a commonly held feeling in the community?
Yes, in 20 seconds, that is definitely a commonly held feeling.
I should like to point out that's less than 20 seconds. Glenn Perkins is here from CityMetro.com. Nick Oxter from WBTV, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and David Borax from WFAE News. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with David Borax, Glenn Birkins, Nick Oxner, and Eric Spenberg gathered around our table just in time for Valentine's Day. The town of Matthews and CMS have made up.
I heart you.
Thank you. Big sloppy wet kiss. Town commissioners voted unanimously on a resolution saying the town has no intention of opening municipal charter schools. And this is what Mayor John Higdon had to say about ending this two-year impasse.
We came to the Captain Obvious consensus opinion that the children in Matthews and all of our towns are better served when our boards work together as partners and not as adversaries.
Higdon was following through on a campaign promise when he ran for mayor to mend fences with CMS. So remind us how this came up in the first place.
Way back in 2018, then North Carolina Representative Bill Brawley, who is from Matthews, ushered through some legislation that allowed four Mecklenburg towns to create a municipal charter system, in large part because they were frustrated with CMS funding. And so what's happened since then is you first had Cornelius in the fall have a similar, hey, we love you, let's all be friends, so that they could avoid a CMS backlash that would have delayed funding to those four towns if they started to build municipal charters.
Because the legislature, Bill Brawley, passed this bill through the legislature that allowed Matthews and Cornelius and Huntersville and was it Davidson?
Mint Hill.
To build their own, to start their own municipal charter schools.
Right.
Several of these communities opted almost from the get-go not to do that. And Matthews, there was a contentious little meeting with the school board, and Matthews, about a year ago, year and a half ago, that essentially said, okay, you want to build your own schools? Then we're not going to build anything else here.
We won't bother funding you for a very, very long time. And as you said at the start of this, Mike, it really hinges on the mayoral election because the previous mayor, Paul Bailey,
who was a member of the school board at one point.
Yes, was very much in favor of municipal charters. And so when he lost, and the race was basically about this issue, you could see what was coming. And that's exactly what transpired this week.
And another thing that happened is that Bill Brawley lost his legislative seat in the 2018 election to Rachel Hunt. So he's out of the picture. So now
real quick, a lot of talk about him running again, so that could change things up as
you
well.
You see, your vote does matter.
Sorry, go ahead, David.
Votes have consequences. So what does Matthews get from the reunification with CMS? What do they get?
Well, I think, you know, they're not frozen out, I guess, for lack of a better term, is, you know, you're back in the mix for projects. And I think what they realized was that if they didn't do this, they were going to have a really difficult time going.
I just wanted to say that Mint Hill has never really spoken loudly about the desire to do this, so they're not really in the picture on this. Mm-hmm. This leaves Huntersville alone pursuing this option, and they've had a committee that's been meeting to look into it. How much would it cost? How would we do it? And how would it work? And as far as we know, they have shown none of the same willingness to meet up again with CMS.
Hmm. Would we know about it, or would CMS be keeping that close to the vest? Does this end this chapter, then, at least for Matthews? Does this end this?
Yeah, I think so. And even what David says, I suspect that all four eventually are going to fall in line. But
I don't
maybe
know.
Not.
Huntersville
maybe Huntersville
has,
will, you know.
I mean, even Matthews, even before Paul Bailey lost his reelection, was like,
There's a loud element there.
Do we really want to do this? We want the option to do this, but do we want to do it? Which is different than Huntersville, which is still making moves to be like, yeah, we think we might want to do this. And so they have not shown any signs of letting up yet. And they have elected officials up there that I think enjoy kind of going against the grain. So it would not surprise me one bit.
Well, there is that ideology. North MEC aspect, I guess, to it. North MEC is mad about a lot of things, so that might further motivate them. That's true. Good point.
Okay, we're 6 months away from the arrival of the Republican National Convention, which is in mid-August. Chief Kerr Putney, who was the chief here in 2012 when the Democratic National Convention was here, feels confident that he has things under control and he won't be asking for a new crowd control ordinance. When the DNC was here, there was one. I think he asked for one. He got one.
Wasn't he deputy? Wasn't Monroe still chief in 2012?
Maybe.
I think so. But he was here. He's very much part of it.
But they had the Extraordinary Events Ordinance, which was applied to that event and many other events. You couldn't carry backpacks. You couldn't do this, you couldn't do that. That was later repealed. So why doesn't he feel that he needs this extra tool for what could be a contentious event?
I mean, basically what he said the other night is that they feel like they have plenty of experience from 2012 to do this without that ordinance in place. And also he was talking a lot about the security perimeter and how it will be similar to 2012. So it just sounded like they didn't really see the need to do this again because they had so many other elements in place.
I'm not sure we know enough to know exactly why he decided against it, because certain parts of the old ordinance did make sense for extraordinary events. Certain things you could not carry, chains, and there were some other things that I kind of questioned. I think umbrellas were in there and
couldn't wear masks.
Yes, couldn't wear masks. But
if you think about the experience this city has had now dealing with riots and protests in the time since the 2012 DNC, the police department has learned a lot, I have to imagine, has experienced a lot. And if you recall back to the riot following the Keith Lamont Scott shooting, CMPD did a pretty good job of the officers controlling themselves, and except for one night, more or less controlling the crowd. And maybe they realized from situations like that maybe we don't need these other tools, which amount in some ways on some restrictions on civil liberties.
And remember, they were the ones who came to the council and said, we should repeal this.
Right.
And that was part of an effort to improve their standing with the community. I mean, this ordinance was a really sticking point with a lot of people. And do we need this? I mean, remember after the Keith Scott shooting, the ordinance was still in effect, and there were people who were arrested for wearing masks or whatever. I remember the Sunday after that protests out at the stadium, there were a bunch of people arrested. All those charges were dropped, so that didn't really have any lasting effect there. And I think that, CMPD believes they can do it with what they have in their pocket right now.
I think one of the problems with the old ordinance is that it was supposed to be for extraordinary events, but it ended up being for very ordinary events.
It was almost every day.
That happened quite often. I actually do see this convention as being something extraordinary. But if Chief Putney feels that the department doesn't need it, then I'm sure he knows what he's
doing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this convention will be smaller. There won't be as many people here as there were in 2012.
Fewer delegates.
Fewer delegates, but 50,000 visitors. I mean, so it's still sizable.
More news media.
More news media. But I was going to ask anyone around the table, because I didn't hear the answer to this. Does Secret Service have ultimate say on everything that happens security-wise? In other words, if they want to ban, so that's what I would think as well. So if they come in and they say, we don't want backpacks or whatever it is, then...
Within the perimeter.
Right, that's what I mean, within the perimeter.
But then if you have an extraordinary event, that would apply to things maybe inside now, under the old ordinance.
Yeah.
So, so once the security perimeter, the Secret Service has the final say.
So that's what I'm saying. What I wondered was whether Putney and the police looked at it and said, look, if there's an issue like that, Secret Service can take care of it. We don't need a local ordinance.
And we don't know what the perimeter is yet.
We don't.
Okay.
That will be announced by the Secret Service.
Okay. WBTV is reporting that the Charlotte City Manager, Marcus Jones, largely deferred to CMPD Chief Kerr Putney over a 2017 decision over whether to side with the chief of the and the Citizens Review Board in the use of force case. Tell me what this is about, because I just screwed it all up.
Sure. So, Mike, let's start with this. Last week, the Citizens Review Board voted to disagree with Chief Kerputney's findings that there were no policy violations by Officer Wendy Curl in the fatal shooting of Dan Queers Franklin at the Burger King parking lot last spring. That was only the second time in the board's 23-plus year history that they had taken such a vote. The first time they had voted to disagree with the chief was in 2017 in an incident that involved a then CMPD police officer named John Dunham, pressing his pistol to the head of an unarmed man and saying, quote, "I will kill you." That ensued after a foot chase. The man had run from police, and then they proceeded to use a number of different ways to beat on the man.
And all of that was caught on body cam footage, which we have all seen because it was on television. Chief Putney determined at the time that when the officer put the gun to James Yarborough's head and threatened to kill him, he had in fact violated policy, but he did not deem it as use of excessive force. So Yarborough took his case to the Citizens Review Board. Is that correct?
Eventually. That's correct. And it's important to note, Chief Putney found that he violated a policy that was conduct unbecoming, pressing your gun to the head of an unarmed man. And this never would have become public had James Yarbrough not managed to get the body camera footage himself and get it to us at WBTV. He had tried to launch a complaint at CMPD prior to doing all that by showing up at CMPD and filing a complaint, and no one investigated it. And so we publicize the tape, it comes out, then he goes to the CRB, and the CRB at the time ultimately voted to disagree with the chief. The story that we did, this was all rehashed to set up the story that we did this week, Mike, and that is the fact, what actually happened after the CRB voted to disagree with the chief, specifically on the findings that he did not violate policy regarding excessive force. And the answer to that is functionally nothing, because court documents or documents filed in court, as well as deposition transcripts filed in a civil rights case that James Yarbrough brought against the city following that, show that when the CRB votes to disagree with the chief, the next step is that the city manager has the ultimate say. Was the chief right, or was the CRB right in saying that the chief was wrong? And the city manager testified, in making his final decision, he decided that the chief was right. And who did he consult to make that final decision? The chief. Mm.
Glenn.
I've been in the room with Chief Putney a number of times in a number of venues where he's appealed to the public not to settle their disputes with law enforcement in the street, to live another day and take it to the department and through the channels. And this appears to be what happened here, as Nick said, and nothing was done until the media started looking into this. This young man filed a complaint, just as the chief has said the public should, and it was ignored. I think the chief has to realize that there is a court of public opinion here as well. This isn't just about whether this officer violated policy or what the technical definition of excessive force is. I think most people would say that a person who is unarmed, who is not posing a serious bodily threat to law enforcement, should not have a gun pressed to their head and
their life threatened.
And their life threatened. I think most people would say that's excessive.
Yeah. He was running away from the police, not toward them.
Right. And I'm not defending someone running away from police. I'm not defending someone struggling with police who are trying to get that person under control. I want to be clear there. But these are professional trained law enforcement officers, and that type of behavior, I think most people would agree, should not have a gun pressed to their head.
And here's the interesting thing about that, Glenn, is one of the findings in the Citizens Review Board, it's a confidential memo that came out, we obtained it because it was filed in court, but they found specifically that the police officer, in his write-up in justifying why he took out his weapon at all, he said because he thought James Yarbrough was reaching for his waistband. But in reviewing the video and reviewing the testimony of Officer Yarbrough, they found that they didn't think he was right. They found him to be untruthful in trying to justify why he even pulled his service weapon at all. And so those were among the very detailed findings from the Citizens Review Board. And ultimately, the way the process is supposed to work, from everything I can find, is that Marcus Jones, as the city manager, is supposed to be the one who reads these very detailed, very nuanced findings from the CRB, looks at the video on his own, and then makes a final determination. What he testified to under oath in his deposition is that he read the CRB's findings, consulted with Chief Kerr-Putney, and ultimately found that Chief Kerr-Putney's position was reasonable.
Well, and a couple of things there. One is that I believe your report also included that Marcus Jones said that he went to Putney because Putney is the expert.
Yep.
And while obviously he is the expert, I think to your point, Glenn, this is a matter of public opinion. And Lord knows CMPD understands that. They've been through so many of these things. And when they are talking so often about de-escalation, mm-hmm. and you have something that seems this crystal clear. I mean, a lot of these things are very gray. This one is not very gray. It doesn't seem to be anyway. And still, there was this hesitancy, and the chief even said that he didn't think civilians should be weighing in on something like this. And I think that's probably a statement he might want back.
Okay. David, you reported this week that all but one tenant has now moved out of the rundown Lake Arbor apartments in West Charlotte, and that a legal battle in a class action suit between the tenants and the New York company that owns it is going on. But now the entire complex is up for sale. What are the implications of that?
Right. So before the owners decided last summer to tell the tenants that they had to be out so that they could renovate the complex, some tenants had filed suit against the owners because they said that they were collecting illegal rent and fees at a time when their apartments were not passing safety and health inspections. And so that is illegal in North Carolina to do that. They want their money back. This lawsuit has been in court. There have been lots of depositions and discussions about it. It turns out that all during this time, the owners were trying to sell the complex to another investment company for $16 million. And the lawyers for the tenants got wind of this recently, and they went to the court here in Mecklenburg County and said, can we get a legal attachment of the bank accounts and the property so that we can be sure there will be money to pay these claims if the tenants win. So Judge Lisa Bell a couple of weeks ago agreed, and she put a $1.3 million, basically a lien on the property, which says if anybody tries to buy this, they will be liable for this judgment if it works out that way. So that's where we are with that. There's only one tenant left living in the complex. It's somebody who's had trouble finding housing, and I talked to the lawyer for the owners, and he said they are trying to work with that person. The owners will not comment on either the lawsuit or the possible sale, but it looks like that is probably going to happen. One other side note, I learned this week that another company, another local group, wanted to buy it and maybe preserve it as affordable housing, but they got outbid. And Julie Eiselt of the city council says, that's frustrating. We don't have the tools to do this.
We know that the arts community is in trouble financially. We're going to talk about the ASC when we come back. But Actors Theater put out a plea to patrons last week for money to sustain its operations by saying that without it, it would have to cease operations. And Chip Decker, the company's artistic director, told me this week that he needed around $35,000 just to pay the rights fees on the plays they want to produce. And they couldn't do that without replenishing their reserve fees. So almost immediately after that plea went out for help, they got $72,000, which is about half of what they need. They are not in the red. They are in the black, and they intend to stay that way. They'll fold before they go into the red, he said. So at least they're getting some help somewhere, but they still need more. And these problems are not necessarily connected to the problems we're about to talk about with the ASC. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about a bond package for pedestrian safety. And big endorsement in a presidential race near and dear to us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That's why David Borax is here from WFAE News. Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. 3 months after Mecklenburg County voters rejected a sales tax increase for the arts, parks, and education, pushed by the Arts and Science Council, that group's president, Jeep Bryant, went to the county commission to ask for a $5 million increase in their annual funding allotment.
As you probably know, our near-term focus is really on ensuring we're able to put our arts, science, and history sector on a more stable and sustainable path. And so to that end, we really do appreciate your consideration of this budget request.
So Jeep told commissioners he'd be going to the city for $7 million. That's up from the current 3.2. That amounts to $12 million. And if I've done the math right, that's about half of what the sales tax increase would have brought in. How was he received by county commission?
You know, it wasn't as skeptical as I may have expected. Now, there were a lot of questions. Nobody said, hey, we're just going to hand you more than twice what we've been handing you. But there was some openness to the fact that Arts and Science Council doesn't really have many places to go. So what they really focused on was, we want to see your entire budget. We want to see what else you're spending on. We don't just want to know what you're doing with the county money. Vilma Leek was pretty. You've got a clip, I will stop speaking and let her speak.
No, Vilma Leek was a little skeptical, and she said it would be a tough request for her.
I'm concerned about the amount of money you're asking for when the county said no to the bonds, the process for the citizens to vote for it. They said no.
Did they say no to more money for the arts, or did they say no because of all of the mitigating factors that we've talked about ad nauseum on this program? The fact that the bond referendum was worded very opaquely, that there was no guarantee that the money would continue to be used for the way it was intended, and there was no mechanism to administer the doling out of the money at the time that the bond was written.
I think this is one where it's in the eye of the beholder. Of course, ASC and members of the county commission said, oh, no, no, no. Everybody loves the arts, and they want to give the arts more money. It's just, you know, this was a sloppy bond campaign. They didn't say that way, but, you know, voters just didn't want to raise taxes. But clearly, this is being presented as, we know you want to support arts, so we're just going to give you another way to try and do it. Now, whether they will actually do it and how city council will receive this request. I mean, when he sort of dropped that bomb in the middle of the meeting that, yeah, I'm going to ask for $7 million from the city. You know, we haven't heard much from the city. The mayor did tell me a week or two ago that they want to try and help the arts community. But what does that mean? And also, Mike, I have to mention this. They also have said they need more money from the private sector. There was no mention of any specifics of, okay, we're getting $3 million now. We'd like to get $6 or $7 or whatever. There was no mention of that. So in a business community that's this healthy, that number is very relevant.
And if I were a member of the city council or county commission, I'd be asking, why haven't you been able to raise this money privately yourself? I mean, and it seems from an organization that has been in the community this long and has been fundraising this long, how do you feels like kind of suddenly end up in the emergency zone, right? I mean, for the last year, they've been screaming how dire need of money they are. But it wonders why their only real answer has been turning to government and taxpayers.
And there's been a real change in the ASC's model. I mean, remember, you know, going back a decade, it used to be that there would be workplace giving campaigns and you could give to the ASC with a deduction out of your paycheck every week. And that helped them build up their coffers, and they were very successful for a long time. And then for a variety of reasons, recession, concern about workplace giving campaigns, especially around other organizations that had basically corruption at the top and all of that, people became less willing to
he
do
meant
that.
The United Way scandal obviously was a big
exactly
part of that.
Here in Charlotte.
Plus, there isn't the kind of corporate mandate. In 1985, right, when I came here, there was a corporate mandate. You will give.
Yes.
You got locked
that's
in a room
gone
with a card that
that's
had,
right,
had a number on it.
Yeah. So when you said that they want to know how they're spending their money, I know Vilma Leek asked Jeep Bryant what his salary was, and he told her. That they're cutting staff by 15%, but they still have 31 people. I don't know what they make.
Yeah.
Is that what they want to know?
Yeah, that was interesting. Jeep Bryant said that they had cut four positions, gone from 35 to 31 right after the vote, and that by removing those four positions, they had lowered their payroll by 15%. So obviously these were high-level jobs. But Vilma Leek was asking, and other commissioners asked too, but Vilma Leek really hammered this point about wanting to know not only what people were making, but the diversity of the staff. You know, she's talked a lot about having access in low-income areas to the arts, but she's also talking about the diversity of the staff itself.
Well, she feels that they haven't really done what they promised they were going to do and do outreach into those communities. You're shaking your head, Glenn.
Well, they are doing outreach into those communities. There's a survey out there now where they're trying to get public input into what residents want, what they value, what they think the ASC should be investing its money in. And I've talked with ASC leaders, and they very, very much want to know what members of the African American community want, and they're making extraordinary efforts to get that information to reach those communities.
By the way, Jeep Bryant will be on this program with members of the arts community on Wednesday for a deeper discussion of this. Sustain Charlotte wants $50 million from a proposed $197 million bond package dedicated to to be dedicated to walking and cycling safety and expanded lanes and paths around town. This will be on the November ballot, I believe. It's the fourth and final piece of an eight-year, $785 million capital program for economic development. And Shannon Binns, who is the organization's founder, Sustain Charlotte's founder and the executive director, has been lobbying the city. What has to happen for the city to agree to this very quickly?
Well, the city manager, in essence, and the staff will decide what the priorities are, and they can shuffle projects in there, and if they decide to do this, then it will appear on the ballot.
So will this be different from the arts proposal on the ballot last November was for arts, parks, and education. Will this be different because it will not involve a tax increase?
Will not involve a tax increase. Now, this is funding projects with bonds.
Okay. You're reporting, Nick, this week that a district judge in Mecklenburg County has taken years to enter orders in dozens of cases, which have left families in limbo, because this is all family court cases, divorce cases, alimony, child support, etc. And years have gone by without, what, her ruling on these?
That's correct. Our story looked at the outstanding orders in front of Judge Aretha Blake, a district court judge, and we reported that there were 52 cases that had been pending since 2017, without orders. We talked with a woman on our story who we didn't identify, who had been waiting on a child support order to help raise her three children and hadn't had a child support order of any kind since 2017, and as a result, hadn't been getting the support she needed to help raise her family.
So why is this happening, or not happening, as the case may be?
Well, because Judge Blake's not entering the orders. And
why?
We tried to ask her. She didn't answer our questions.
You also looked at her time card. Essentially, the judges have to punch in and punch out at the courthouse. Is that right?
Well, we looked at swipe records. You have to badge in and badge out to get the security to the parking deck. And that the swipe records don't tell a full story. We never meant to imply they do. However, if you have such a backlog of cases, it's important to look at how much time you're spending at the office. And the answer is just more than half the amount of time than if she had been at the office 40 hours.
So she's not faced any discipline for this from the court system. So where does this go from here?
The only mechanism for oversight and discipline for judges in North Carolina is a body called the Judicial Standards Commission. By law, that commission operates in total secret and can discipline people in total secret, can also discipline people publicly. It's a slow process. There have been two Mecklenburg County District Court judges in kind of recent history that have been disciplined for taking a year or more to rule in one family court case, let alone 52 family court cases, and so we will see what, if anything, happens.
That kind of goes to the question that I had for you, Nick. Is this an isolated thing, or do we know how she compares to her colleagues at the court?
Sure, and I've not sat down and done a case-by-case study, but every person that I've talked to at the courthouse and in the family law system says there is no other judge that has a backlog of 52 cases. The typical turnaround for an order is 1 to 3 months.
Okay, Iowa and New Hampshire have resulted in some surprises for Democrats, but especially for former Vice President Joe Biden, who had a miserable showing in both states before the polls had closed in New Hampshire. This week, Biden was already on a plane to South Carolina to rally the troops there.
You know, I hope you love me as much as I love you guys.
Do I detect just a hint of desperation?
That's unfair to the word hint.
We spent an hour yesterday at Winthrop University talking about the February 29th South Carolina primary, and the name that kept emerging there was that of Tom Steyer. Could he be surprising us all in South Carolina in a couple of weeks? You don't know. I'm just asking you to speculate.
Well, yeah, look, he has actually spent, and this came out of first time a couple weeks ago when polling came and Steyer was, in second place at the time? And people said, whoa, where'd that come from? Because he's been
TV ads.
Yeah, right. Well, that's exactly right? He has a lot of money. He can run TV ads. And he's been focusing on South Carolina. And from all the reporting that you see from people on the ground in South Carolina, it's that his message, backed by a lot of money, is actually kind of resonating.
You're saying a billionaire could go out and spend a lot of his own money on ads and just start rising in the poll?
Well, I don't know, but Michael Bloomberg thinks so. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, he's not paying much attention to South Carolina, but he is paying attention to North Carolina.
Well, he's been to Gainesboro.
He has a 17,000 square foot headquarters here in Charlotte, but I'm funny you should mention Gainsborough, because here he is speaking in Gainsborough.
We have 124 people across this state, and we have 8 offices, including one here in Gainsborough, and we have momentum. But we're going to pull this country together, and I'm not going to miss one state, small or big, east, west, north, south, whatever.
Whatever.
whatever flyover state I'm in, I would love to have your delegates.
The crowd sounded a little puzzled about Gainsborough. He was in Greensboro when he made that statement. He is spending a personal fortune on this race, and he's racking up some interesting endorsements. Former Governor Bev Perdue has endorsed him and will co-chair his state campaign along with Hugh McCall. She said, quote, "I wanted somebody who's a doer, who is an adult in the room, who can fix things. I think he's the only candidate in the race to have the potential to bring independents and Republicans along with him." He has also received the endorsement of Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles.
Mayor Bloomberg brings in that experience of having managed a large organization that's very urban, and at the same time, and since leaving office, he has addressed national issues like climate change.
She's the latest mayor to endorse him, Columbia Mayor Stephen Benjamin, who co-chairs his national campaign, has endorsed him, and Charlotte City Councilman James Mitchell is the state director of his campaign. How important is all of it? What is this saying? What's happening here? Is this mainline Democrat saying it's not going to be Bernie and it's not going to be this mayor of a small town, it's going to be somebody who can beat Donald Trump?
With the exception of Beverly Perdue and Hugh McCall, most the people you named are African American. Mm-hmm. If you're in the Democratic Party, you don't get the nomination without the support of African Americans. So I think one of the things you're seeing is that he is making that appeal through some very high level endorsements. You have, as you mentioned, the mayor of Charlotte, the mayor of Columbia, James Mitchell working with him here in Charlotte. I think it's a recognition that that the African American community is essential to whoever gets that nomination.
Well, and particularly for this candidate, when you look at Stop at Frisk and all the racial baggage that comes with him, and Mike, I'm not trying to get in your way, but I bet you're going to read something that was on Twitter last night.
Well, he's not. Not all African Americans are in favor. Vi Lyles' daughter responding on Twitter last night. She says, "I have no words to describe how devastatingly disappointed I am in every Democratic mayor who has endorsed Michael Bloomberg, particularly the black ones, and especially the ones closest to me. We don't win, change the status quo, build any collective power of divested communities under attack by being easily seduced by the power of another billionaire who uses racist policies to oppress and profit. If you're black, Latino, LGBTQ, Muslim, drowning in college debt, worried about being displaced from your community without quality, affordable health care, or have been the victim of state violence, and you voted for someone who isn't standing up for you, I'm sorry." That's Vi Lyles' daughter.
So, and going back to Glenn's point, what we're about to have here is a titanic clash in the Democratic Party about which way it goes next.
Well, I asked a Democratic strategist who was on the panel at Winthrop University, the very last question in the show, is there going to be a contested convention? You bet. There is going to be one. It should be fun.
I was going to say. Milwaukee?
The other endorsement we left out is Alma Adams. She also came out, another African-American politician who is supporting.
I mean, it really is pragmatism versus idealism, and that's what we're getting into.
So Bernie's coming here today at 3 o'clock to speak at the Belk. We don't have time to talk about the McClatchy bankruptcy declaration. How does that affect the Observer? Does it?
In the short term, they're promising no changes, but it's hard to see that a hedge fund would not have different idea about who needs to be in a newsroom.
Yeah. I'm a future pensioner,
yes,
I'm reading every word.
It does affect the pension.
Well, that's what this is really about. How can they shed that enormous pension obligation.
I want to remind everybody that this weekend marks Riverboat Ron's yard sale, and it's all for a good cause. You get to meet him. It's 12 to 3 at the Toomey Avenue location of the Humane Society. And I don't get to tell you that we live in one of the best places in the country to live in. We'll do that. We'll save that for another listicle. That's right. David Borax, Glenn Birkins, Nick Oxner, Eric Spanberg, thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.